This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Welcome, everybody. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this fine summer day?
I mean, good. Evening. Very good. Good. All's well.
All's well. Well, very good. Well, we just had here in America, we've had the 4th of July. Dr. Lyle, do you know that they actually, do you know if they have a 4th of July in England or not?
Yes, they do.
I can't stump you.
They don't celebrate it. What's that?
Oh, but I just see. Can't I got stump it. You.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah. All good.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got a couple of questions that we're going to finish up for today. We might have a live caller or so, but let's just get right into it. So,
okay.
All right. Dear Dr. Lyle, how do you deal with a partner who's intolerant to other partners' opinions? It could be anything, maybe finance, food, a choice of how to spend free time and how to raise a child. What is this signaling about this person? And a follow-up question is, my partner and I represent different cultures. We have a child and have a different view on how to raise him. I'm a very conscientious person, so I strive for excellence and hard work. I require from my child to do work to the best of his ability and to do extra work, whereas my partner has a pretty different approach. He's a lot less conscientious. For him, it's more important to give the child some more free time and an option to do whatever he wants. What say you?
Well, there's sort of two questions here are being asked, and they're somewhat different. And so the overarching question is the notion that we've got two parents here, two partners that are where they're having disagreements. And so it sounds like the disagreements are, you know, among a range of issues. And then the issue that specifically the questioner is talking about is this issue of how to raise a child. Now, two different cultures. The person who wrote this is obviously very conscientious, talking about getting the kid to do extra work, work to the best of his ability, et cetera. So there's striving for excellence. This all sounds there are certain. People in the world, by virtue of their own high conscientiousness, not to be racist, but this is very typical of Asian cultures. And so there's an extremely high conscientiousness there. And so it sounds like, the reason I say this, it sounds like these two people are from two different cultures, and I can imagine that the highly conscientious person could be Asian. And it wouldn't be typical for an American to be complaining about someone else not being conscientious. So that being the case, that's likely being the case, what we're talking about here then is anxiety, because conscientiousness is fundamentally an anxious derivative. So if you can imagine a bell curve of conscientiousness, and imagine that on the low conscientious side, the person has very low anxiety. And in the middle, they have a medium amount of anxiety. And the high side, they have very high anxiety. And so the high anxiety is essentially at the very upper reaches of this. You can see that the person is overestimating the worst-case scenario. The person on the low end of conscientiousness is underestimating the worst-case scenario. And people in the middle of the bell curve are estimating the worst-case scenario typical for our species, which means on average it's going to be pretty good. Now, high conscientious people are extremely valuable for many things. Low conscientious people are not valuable for much of anything. the in other words, that characteristic of them is not valuable. The high conscience, unless you need somebody to do something really nasty, and you just you know, like a hitman would be a good thing. If you wanted a cheap hitman, you want somebody that's low in conscientiousness. It's a perfect situation. But high conscientiousness, these are the people that you want running your companies. This is who you want in your HR department. This is who you want head of your engineering team, et cetera, et cetera. Now, so now we're going to have a disagreement between these two people who differ in their degree of conscientiousness in terms of child raising. And so the conscientious individual is saying, look, I want the kid to work hard, want him to work harder, et cetera, et cetera. And the other parent is saying, wait a second, I want the kid to have more free time. Now, what I'm going to say isn't necessarily consistent with an overarching strategy for how we would deal with this conflict, a broader conflict between the two people. A broader conflict between the two people, well, let me address that first. What we want to do is we want to sit down and have a little meeting and have, you know, pads of paper in people's hands. And what we want to do is we want to have specific issues, because we're not – you can't change personalities. All you can do is you can actually discuss issues. And in the discussion of issues, specific issues, we're going to be asking questions. And this is what I call crystal clear. So your job is to ask enough questions that you really understand the other person's position in great detail. And then you need to be able to say it back to them. Okay, so this is... So it's essential that if I was going to be doing therapy, or if a couple is going to do this themselves, then they have to have a situation where they have to describe their position, their frustration, and all the reasons for it in such detail that we have one person start and the other person's the listener or questioner. And the questioner has to be able to, you know, they're not going to argue any of their position. They're going to ask and ask and ask and ask and get finer and finer details until we're right down to the point where they can encapsulate and feed back what it is that the other person says, okay? Now, let me explain the reasons for this. First of all, there are certain problems between people that come up, and they can get pretty unpleasant when they have in fact miscommunicated and they do not actually know the other person's position. The second of all, there's a strong tendency in humans to want to win arguments. So we're gonna refrain from that concept, because we're not actually going to be – the goal isn't to win the argument. The goal is to actually fully understand the other person's position as deeply as possible. The second individual who's doing the listening and questioning isn't going to be making any statements or explaining their own position until they're completely finished with the first one. So in this case, it doesn't matter who starts. You can flip a coin, and it doesn't make any difference. One person starts, and they talk, and they talk, and they talk, and they talk, and the other person's all they can do is ask questions, clarify, okay? They can be making clarification statements that are what we're going to call reflections of content. So they can say, so what I see that you are saying is, this is how this works, this is how it works, and this is what you're worried about. The other person says, yes, okay? Now, there's great value to this technique, and the reason where it's a good thing is that the person who is the first person who's complaining, it is a great relief to see that your partner is taking the time and has the patience and is listening very carefully and is asking you very careful questions, even if some of them got a little bite to them, there's a little argumentative tone, doesn't matter, we hang in there. And we get it until the other person, the person who's listening, actually has what I call, they arrive at what I call crystal clear. So they have it absolutely crystal clear. And they can explain the other person's position, and they can feed it back to them, and the original complainant says, yes, 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 you've got it. Okay? So there's a great relief there, because now person number one does not have to be anxious that their position is not fully understood, and they don't have to be anxious that they didn't get it all said, and that we're not in a rush here the way we are normally in an argument for somebody to win it in front of an audience. We're going to take that out of the equation. We're changing the structure of this dialogue. And then we turn it around, And now, person number two now has a little different perspective, and they can be making those comments. Well, like, well, I really had this issue, but now I understand what you're saying on that, so that's changed me a little bit, but I still have this issue and this issue and this issue. And now the issue with person number one is they have to do the same thing, and they have to get the crystal clear. Okay? So the two people, we have to play this game that I call crystal clear. And there's there's another thing that we can do to start this. So when we do this, the notion is, you know, sometimes people need some help. They need to have this modeled for them. Sometimes they need a therapy hour with a therapist that knows what they're doing, so that we can model and show how it is that we go about this conflict resolution. And then at the end, if we have, we can reach a very clear concept of what the nature of the core disagreement is. And then finally, once we can understand what our core disagreement is, and there's no other smoke in the middle of this thing, we know exactly what the disagreement is as best we can articulate it, then our job is to essentially come up with some kind of a compromise or an experiment, okay? Because sometimes the core disagreements have there's anxiety, for example, on the part of the more conscientious person oftentimes, that the other person is being a flake and there's going to be costs associated with us doing it your way as opposed to doing it my way. You can see this. So let's suppose that we've got a husband and wife and the wife is 95th percentile conscientiousness and the husband is 70th. In this case, the wife's going to be having a lot of anxiety and frustration because she's going to be seeing problems coming that the husband seems oblivious to or doesn't care. And this is going to be very frustrating, and this is going to drive a sense that he does not value her opinion, and he is going to feel like she is essentially holier than thou and looking down on him, and this is a bad esteem dynamic. And so by crystal clear, what we're going to do is we're going to talk this through, get down to the details. Now, in this case, we have a specific issue, and the issue on the table here is she wants to drive the kid and make the kid, you know, super conscientious and successful, et cetera, and he doesn't. He wants the kid to goof off and have fun. Now, in this case, what the crystal clear would be, if I was doing this, I would be asking her, what are we trying to accomplish? What are you thinking? Well, I want him to be really successful, okay? And I would say specifically, like what? Like what's the point? What are we thinking? And she would be saying, well, I want him to get really good grades and do things to the best of his ability and work hard, get, you know, do extra credit, et cetera, et cetera. And we would say, and why is that? Okay, because we're seeking crystal clarity here. And she would say, well, I want him to do as well as he possibly can. And we would say, well, why is that? And it'd be like, well, okay, you know, like, isn't it obvious? Okay. I want him to get the very highest GPA that he can in high school. And, you know, he's in the third grade now. There's no time to waste. We have to make sure that he is as prepared as possible because he has to get the highest possible test scores and the highest possible GPA. And we have to ingrain habits in him so that he's a very hard worker, highly conscientious individual. So notice that there's an implication that we're going to influence long-term personality characteristics by this, which we will not, by the way. So we have a mistake, okay? So then, but we're going to continue on, and we're going to find out that this parent, you know, wants him to, you know, get the best possible grades, so he's got the very best high school grades. Now, this seems incredibly reasonable to a highly conscientious individual. Let's find out why. Because she's going to say, because I want him to get into the very best college that he can, okay? And you know what? There might, you know, 0.1%, you know, difference in his GPA or 20 points on the SAT, a few points, you know, a couple of questions. That could be the difference between him getting into, you know, Brown University or University of North Carolina. And so this is of enormous importance that we squeeze out every possible bit of status that we can get out of this, okay? All right, so now we're understanding where she's coming from. She's got anxiety. She wants him to reach as high as possible. Why? Okay, well, that should be obvious to all of us, but we're sometimes not listening. that she wants him to have the very finest pedigree possible on his resume so that he can get a good job. Now, the inference is that if he goes to the University of North Carolina, he'll never get a good job, okay? So he must get into, what did I say, University of Pennsylvania or Brown? I can't remember what I said.
North Carolina,
right.
Yeah.
No, so he's heading to North Carolina instead of the Ivy League, okay? This is a devastating failure. Now, just in case there's any Tar Heels out there, I'm sorry. Sorry about that. Hey, listen, Jordan went to your school. Your school wins. All right, so this kid, you know, so now we got this third grader. We got a lot of pressure on because he's heading for the Ivy League if this woman has, you know, anything to say about it. And he has to get there because then he's going to get the best job. Or actually, not even a job yet. We got to go to grad school first. So if he goes to Carolina, he can't get into a top-tier grad school. Or if he goes to Brown, he might inch his way into Harvard Law School. Okay? So we're aiming for Harvard. Okay? So if he goes to North Carolina, there's no way he's getting into Harvard. This is horrendous to the high conscientious individual as she sees all these doors shut and the paths blocked. Because the kid is not going to wind up, you know, with his first job going to be at Goldman Sachs for $150,000 coming out of law school. And so this is a quiet tragedy. So we are not going to have that tragedy. We're going to work that kid to the bone starting in the third grade. Every time he comes home from school, you know, he's going to have a little snack, take a little short 15-minute nap, and then boom, we're getting to the homework. This is all so we don't have the horrendous outcome of winding up at Georgetown Law School when we could have been at Harvard. And, you know, this would just be a disaster. Now, this is actually what's going on. And why is this? Well, because the woman's son, you know what I mean, we need to have him have every bit of possible cachet because it might make a difference in who he mates with. And if he goes to Georgetown, he might, you know, he's a 7.5. He might wind up with a horrendous situation where his future wife might only be an 8.5. Whereas if he goes to Harvard, he's likely to get a 9. Okay. So therefore, instead of her grandchildren being the product of a 7.5 and an 8.5, which makes them an 8, they're going to be a product of a 7.5 and a 9, which is going to make them an 8.25. So by making them 0.25 points more attractive, this statistically increases the likelihood of gene survival for her. Okay.
Now,
so
I have a question.
She has no – yeah, I'm not even close to being done, but you go ahead and interrupt. Go ahead, Dave. Yeah.
Well, when you put it that way. I'm just curious if you've ever gotten to crystal clear and you keep going through the questions and the mother or the father say – well, obviously, it's because I want the best genes on the planet a couple of generations from now.
I got to admit, nobody's ever called my bluff. So that's very good. I'll wait for it. Someday out there in the future, that's going to happen to me. Very good. Yeah. So the bottom line is that if her grandchild is 0.25 points more sexually attractive, then it's very likely that her great-grandchildren will be 0.125 more attractive, and her great-great-grandchildren will be 0.06, you know, whatever that is, attractive. So these are very important chips on the line if you're a highly conscientious individual, and it's important that we find out that they learn that that's what's driving their anxiety. And so this is a sequence that I explain that I call Why Mom Cares, and the reason why this is on my website at esteemdynamics.org. The why mom cares is because in the Stone Age, it wasn't when your kid didn't graduate from Georgetown and basically have a huge mating pool in front of him. He's going to be picking his way through 150 options, and he's going to optimize what he can get out of those 150 options. And the very top are going to be out, and anything below him is going to be out. So he's going to be essentially fighting it out within a 10 percentile trading range. And in the Stone Age, that wouldn't be possible because you wouldn't have a multitude of options within a narrow trading range. If you get the 9, you get the 9. If you don't get the 9, the next one down might be a 6. And so as a result, if you're the mother of that kid who might be able to compete for the nine, you push him like crazy. Okay, so the anxiety is that there's going to be a very big difference in mating outcomes, as opposed to the fact that the kid is designed by nature to fight it out reasonably, to try to get to get his due, genetic due, and they have a certain amount of conscientiousness and intelligence and charm to get them to make the best deal that they can, and they're not very likely to screw this up. Now, I'm not saying that they don't sometimes make bad choices, but I would say that when the kids make bad choices, the parents would have made worse choices for them. So in this case, I would vote for the dad is what I'm assuming. Maybe I could be flipping this thing around and we could have a super conscientious father and a flaky mother, but I doubt it. So I have a principle when it comes to looking at life and the conflicts between individuals. And that is that we should have a situation where we are optimizing as much freedom as possible for all individuals. That you want, in theory, you want relationships to be as much benefit and as little cost as possible. And you want individuals to be as free as possible of constraint to do whatever it is that they want, so long as they're not forcibly interfering with the rights of other people to do the same. So if your child wants to play video games all day, they are not forcibly interfering with you. And so my attitude is they get to play. Now, they have certain reasonable responsibilities, which is to, you know, do reasonably well in school. It really doesn't make a whole lot of difference how well they do in school at any step of the way. They will become informed, and it will be obvious to them as they get a little bit older, that there's actually things called GPAs and they actually matter. And if I have a kid that I think is significantly underperforming and actually closing doors on himself in high school for what could be a better college career, I would probably let him shut those doors, let him suffer. And that's because he can always wake up later when he's a little bit older and reclaim his genetic greatness by going to the junior college and doing excellent work. And I wouldn't have him go to the junior college and wreck his GPA. If he's going to still be a flake when he's 18, then I'm going to have him pick up a rag and work at a car wash. And he's not going to go to the JC. And so he'll go to school when he's ready, and he's finally ready to do it, and he's got a purpose, and he wants to do well because he's got some target in mind. So in general, the concept of human nature in relationships is that we want to maximize the amount of freedom. So in this case, my attitude would be we would give this kid as much freedom as is all reasonable, and we're running an experiment. We're going to find out just how bad it gets. We're going to find out whether or not he flunks out or whether or not he responds reasonably. If he does not respond reasonably to the challenge that he's supposed to do X well in school, and instead he's screwing up and misusing his time and he's addicted to video games or whatever it is that he's doing, then we take the video games away. It's not a problem, okay, until he can improve his performance. But we begin the process by maximizing the freedom. Our job is to not optimize this kid's performance in some competitive pursuits in a wider cultural dominance hierarchy aimed at his future, okay? We want to inform him of that. We want him to know that there's a wide competitive dominance hierarchy, and we want him to be computing that along the way. But the truth is he will be computing that later in his adolescence when he can see the handwriting on the wall, and we inform him that there's things like tiers of colleges. And if it's important, if he has the ability to do much better, then he should be trying to sniff the coffee here and to figure out that he wants fancier stripes on his head in order to mark himself as a better specimen for the rest of his life. So we are certainly going to inform him of that later, but the variances in where he's going to go are not going to be determined when he's 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 years old. That's not when these variances are going to be determined. So we optimize a kid's life by letting him play, letting him goof off, have as much fun as possible. Those days about having as much fun as possible are just as important as the days to come. A day at 13 years old goofing off and having fun with your friends is just as important as some day at 52. And so to make this a grind, and I believe kids are way too stressed and pressured today by conscientious parents in academic competition. And the bottom line is that your kids will, you know, eventually fight it out and figure out that they need to get serious at some point. And you can be there to remind them just in case they missed it. But we don't have to put their nose to the grindstone, not unless they're really screwing up, and then we need to look at that, and we need to deal with each of those on an individual basis.
Fantastic.
Okay,
this ties in. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Did I interrupt you?
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, this brings us right into the next question, which talks about a kid who was pressuring himself. So.
Mm-hmm.
This question for Dr. Lyle. Okay, so dear Dr. Lyle, I was born to a lower middle class family in India. And when I was mm-hmm. a kid, I had this fire in me to work hard on my studies, get a good mm-hmm. job, and lift my family and its status. And when I look mm-hmm. back, I think of my childhood as a very happy period despite financial struggles and the lack of resources in general. But what's happened to me as I've grown up is this lack of purpose. After turning 18, which is when I moved out from home and college, I've continuously got lazier day by day. I did complete college somehow, but I have low self-esteem about it since I simply exploited loopholes in the system. Nothing illegal. I just figured out how to clear exams by doing just enough. And I didn't really work much to get my degree. And then I worked for a few years in software development from a company where I got even more lazy. And even when I was taking lots of unplanned leaves and slacking off, I was apparently given recognition at work. This kind of led me to a phase of life where I believed I was living the life of the dude in the movie Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
But all this slacking off and getting away with it has come at a cost. I feel gravely unhappy, and I can't remember when I was genuinely happy. Others look mm-hmm. at me and tell me I have a great career and a promising future, but honestly, I feel pretty dead inside once the reality mm-hmm. sinks in. And this attitude towards life has made my health in poor shape, and I know that I may live a lot less if I continue this lifestyle, but I'm not really putting in any effort to move my life in any different trajectory. So my question to you, Dr. Lyle, is this: how can I bring back some purpose into my life?
Great question. Wonderful. Fascinating. A fantastic client question here, actually. So let's look at this and see what we can learn. This person has had an unusual life trajectory, and that is that it sounds as what has happened is that they had as a result of an impoverished upbringing financially, not psychologically. They now come to the United States or wherever it is that they are, and they are able to, by virtue of being very bright and getting into high tech, et cetera, they wind up actually passing over or exceeding what the early, essentially, target was. And so they've actually, the feedback from the world has been better than expected, which is very nice. In other words, it's kind of an interesting situation. We're finding that he's thinking, or she is feeling like they are getting more feedback than they deserve. Now, certainly in many ways it's better to be in that situation than to be in the other situation, but not always. What's happening, there could be definitely some ego trap problems going on here, but there's something else that's going on, and that is that the mind is running complicated cost-benefit analysis on alternative courses of action. That's what it's doing. And this individual is sort of looking out at the cost-benefit options that are in front of him. And he's savvy enough that he can, he seems to be able to get good benefit from relatively mediocre effort. Good enough benefit. In other words, he's comfortable. This reminds me of an animal in a zoo. So if you're an animal in a zoo, you're some lion in the zoo. You know, the guy comes by and throws you a steak a couple times a day, and it's not bad, it's not too bad, it's not too good. You're not doing anything. You're not really getting to be a lion. So this individual is essentially protected by a lot of financial success to the point where he doesn't have to do any lion behavior. And as a result, he is not even close to living up to his potential. He's in a zoo. And the problem with this is that the outside world is actually not particularly giving him any negative feedback. Probably a nice-looking guy, good social skills, he's done well, you know, has good stuff. It's like, hey, this if you got enough brains and you're landing in high tech and things have gone well for you, everything looks great. Okay, now, except that a major component of human happiness is the self-esteem mechanism or the internal audience. So while we are sensitive, very sensitive to feedback from other people, in this case, friendships, romantic potential partners, and trade, and even family, everybody can be giving this guy pretty good feedback. And yet, his internal audience is actually judging him relative to what there's some suspicion about what it is that he could be capable of doing. So the internal audience is seeing, the other people out there may actually be believing that he's trying harder and making essentially that he's reaching 80% of his abilities just like everybody else is. But the truth is this guy could be cruising along on 50% of his abilities. Everybody thinks he's doing perfectly reasonable, but if they knew he was cruising as lackadaisically as he is, they would be kind of disgusted, which is exactly what the internal audience is there for. The internal audience is there as a feedback mechanism to the individual, telling them what other people would think if they were to observe our performances. Okay, so so as a result, the other people would say, God, what a waste of life. Okay, wow, you could be doing so much more with your life. Why aren't you doing something? So this is exactly the feedback that he's getting from the inside, so you can hear it. And the problem is there could be overly high expectations from the self in some ways. There could be I'm not sure what is actually going on. I'd have to ask this person and sort of talk them through. But I feel like they're an animal in a comfortable zoo, and all I can tell you is that the thing that is causing the suffering in this individual's life is unbelievable, and that it is essentially entirely under his control. So this is not true for most people. Most people have goals and desires that can exceed their ability to reach them, and they will have a great deal of frustration as they make efforts and then fail. Okay, this person is not having that situation. So this person's only problem is the internal audience. And the problem is that he doesn't have a lot of force from the outside saying we're rejecting you unless you perform better. So he can cruise along here at, you know, he's a Lamborghini cruising along at 55 miles an hour. And this is no way to drive a Lamborghini. So I would say this, that this person should run an experiment, okay? They should run an experiment, and we can use a variety of mental techniques to get them to run this experiment. But one experiment would be to make a short list of things that they might want to change about their situation. And one of them might be, for example, his physical fitness. One of them might be whether or not he's really doing the job to his best of his ability. And it can be a bizarre and exciting experiment to get yourself ready. I usually don't have people flip a switch on this, like just as it's occurring to them. I have them get ready for it. So, for example, this week, this is Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Okay, he could get ready, and his day one could be next Monday. So what we're going to do is we're going to have, like, no junk food in the house. We're going to get a calendar out. We're going to figure out when we're going to work out. We're going to work out daily, but we're not going to work out super hard. We're going to work out medium hard every day. Okay? And we're going to eat healthy food. We're going to set the clock. We're going to get to bed on time. And then we're going to have, we're going to think about, actually, when we're at work, our plan is going to be to do the job to the very best of our ability. Okay? And the notion is, I want you to feel like that you are a kingpin right at the center of saving hundreds of thousands of lives in warfare. And your job is to actually do everything to the very best of your ability during those hours where you're responsible. You are not responsible. We're not in an emergency situation where, you know, 5 o'clock you get to punch out or six. Okay? So that person actually would be a very good thing for them to stay a half hour late and work, not just to be showing off that they're there, but actually work. Put in an extra half an hour. Okay? If you do this, this person will do this for 2 weeks. Get up, work, you know, work out, go to work, do a superlative job. Okay? Do the very best job you can, not in a frenetic, crazy way, but just one judgment after the next. Focus, execute, focus, execute. Okay? If you do your job too efficiently and you get ahead of the game, you ask your superior what else you can do. Okay? So, you know, don't go crazy here. Don't land yourself in a bucket of trouble. But the point is be smart about it, but push your agendas, essentially try to get superbly organized and move ahead. This is a very interesting 2-week experiment that I believe that you will find that in a couple of weeks, if you will put your pedal to the metal, your internal audience will actually start to be impressed. And internal audience will start to say, this is fascinating, that this actually feels good, and we are actually going to kick out some pride into your nervous system. We're going to signal to the esteem meter, to the self, that we respect what it is that you're doing. Okay? Guess what? There's no other way to activate the system. There's no other way to do it. The pride mechanism is there to signal to you when the internal audience knows you have done a very good job. You don't have to do your very best, but you have done an excellent job. And the internal audience says, well done. Okay? And so it will kick out the pride mechanism. Now, if you go buy an old chair, you know, from a swap meet and take it home and get a can of paint from Home Depot and sand it down and paint it, it's going to give you a little bit of pride because it wasn't that hard. But you did do something diligent and it was a little bit productive, so it gave you a little bit. But if you take on, you know, more seriousness, you know, you try to do your work in an excellent fashion, you can find that this can turn you around. I will tell you an interesting story. A good friend of mine was married. I actually do have a couple of friends that managed to get married. And his wife had a father, and that father, way back when he was young, he worked. I can't remember what he worked in, but it was back in like New Jersey. So he worked in some factory. And it was before the day that the factory was unionized. So as a young man, for the first couple of years of his career, he felt the competitive pressure that you could lose your job and that you had to demonstrate that you were really good or that they might can you. So he actually liked his job. And he went there and he worked as effectively and intelligently as possible. Then the unions came in and unionized the shop. And then there was a lot of pressure to not be so good. And essentially the culture changed dramatically, and it was basically all about flaking out and not working that hard. And so for the next 40 years, this guy hated his job. And about a year before his retirement, for some reason, about 18 months before, he decided one day that he was going to change it up and he was going to work really hard again. This is very interesting. So he did, okay? And it started disturbing people. And he had the attitude of the hell with you. You know, I'm 63 years old. I've got my retirement anyway. I'm going to work till I'm 65. And basically, I don't give a damn. I've been at this company for 37 years or whatever it is. He's just going to do it. And he did it, okay? And he loved his job again. Isn't that interesting?
Wow.
So
can he move over to over here? There's a freeway section that they've been working on for like 7 years, and it's like a small section. They won't even finish it. But he's probably retired by now, and happy
he's
too.
Retired. Happy to. So anyway, this is the point, and this is the message to our person, that your own happiness is actually in your own hands. And so we have to realize that you're in a funny little trap. This is a variant of what I call the pleasure trap, and that is that animals are designed by nature to pursue pleasure, avoid pain, and conserve energy. And this person is in energy conservation mode and is essentially doing the minimum. And by doing the minimum, he's basically in the zoo. He's getting fed his steaks. And everything's okay, but it's not okay. Okay. And so don't make the mistake that this guy did for 37 years and basically be kind of miserable and self-disgusted for 37 years. Instead, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, realize you're in a very interesting trap, work directly against your instincts here, and in fact expend energy, and in doing so, you're going to break through some of these barriers. And my guess is that there are, if this person has this kind of talent, that there are very interesting and exciting and even potentially a little bit career dangerous things for this person to be doing. This person needs to extend themselves and be in a much more adventurous situation. This is why a lot of these guys absolutely love startups. Okay, so if you get a startup with 12 people in it and everybody's got a plan to get rich, you know, there's a degree of excitement there that is you just are not going to find working from a tell. It's just never going to happen. And so this person may be in a big, solid firm that, you know, the paychecks just keep coming like a machine, and that could be a problem. So first experiment and find out how much leverage you have over your own internal audience, that in fact your happiness is in your own hands. And then after that, we start thinking about major structural changes in this person's life that may be in order because they need to be challenged. We need to let the lion out of the zoo and let him be a lion. And at that point, they're going to be a lot happier.
Wow. Well, we've got two more questions. One of them has to do with millennials, and the one has to do with more parenting styles. But before we get to those two, we actually have a caller on the line. So I'm going to bring in this caller. Caller, how are you doing today? What's your name, and where are you calling from?
Hello?
No.
Yes, caller. Oh, can you hear us? I think. Oh, excellent. Yeah. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
This is AJ.
Oh, AJ.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the show.
I love this show. Is there a support group? Because I'm addicted to it now, and I listen to it like 4 hours a day. Is there somewhere to go? Because I'm so into this podcast. It's like I can't stop listening. And I end up on the spin bike for like 4 hours because I'm so drawn in. It's so good, and I've told so many people about it. But actually, that's not why I'm calling. So every time you say one thing, I think of like 10 questions. But I get where you're coming from. You say like the purpose of life is passed on our genes and all that kind of stuff. I get it. So if that's true, then why do people want to continue having sex when reproduction is impossible? So men that have had vasectomies, postmenopausal women, old men in a nursing home, why on earth would people still want to have sex when they can't pass on their genes anymore?
Because the system is designed with goals. It's not designed to be that savvy about when this stops. So believe me, some old guy in the nursing home, he's still thinking that he could knock somebody up. I know, because I've met some of those guys. I worked in the nursing home for a short bit, and believe me, that's still drifting through their heads. And amazingly, even postmenopausal women are very conscious of their attractiveness, and they may or may not be very sexualized in their psychology, but they are still feeling the competitive issues. And they still want to be sexually attractive, even though they might not want to do anything about it. So, and believe me, there are postmenopausal women that are very sexual and interested. So this is all sort of individual differences here. But the machine is sort of a fixed machine. It's think of it as a very sophisticated robot that has programs in it, and the programs are diverse. So I think you'll see, for example, in males and females as they age, you will see a shifting of the programs of the female to what we're going to call, you know, grandmother circuits. So essentially reproduction for them becomes aiding and abetting their grandchildren's ability to compete in their generations and therefore be more sexually successful. So that, whereas a male at 65, which believe me, that's not that far over the right. Yeah. Point is that, believe me, I have every evidence that at 65, I'm going to be as interested in theoretically knocking somebody up as I ever was.
but you know, like our ancestors didn't live this long, so they weren't having sex into their, you know, 60s and 80s. Because for women, it gets harder sometimes physiologically to have sex. You know, like first they get, you know, all these complications, and yet they still want to do it.
Yeah. Oh, well. Life's difficult, you know. You live long enough. You know what? At some point, AJ, when you're 50 years old, you're just out of warranty. That's all there is to it.
But so it's not about the dopamine. It's not because we just are constantly looking for sources of dopamine, and sex is one of the ways to get them. It has nothing to do with that. It's all about the genes and passing them on.
I'm not sure kind of what you're saying. The dopamine is one of many devices that is used to encourage behavior that could be biologically successful.
Mm-hmm.
But dopamine is just one thing. Dopamine, I've talked a lot about in my career because my career has been a lot related to the drug-like properties of processed food and the fact that it's hard for people to get away from them, and then they get overweight and they have sickness, et cetera. But when it comes to motivation more globally, it's happening with many different signaling devices in terms of neurotransmitters, many different kinds of feeling. So we're seeking every little type of mood shift that a human has is a signal to tell it whether those circumstances are either conducive to gene survival or deleterious. And so those are the little mood shifts that you have literally when your toe hurts and it's like, you're a little frustrated about this, or you put on a pair of shoes that's a little tight, and you get home and you love the shoes because you thought they made you look sexy, but now your feet hurt, and now you're frustrated that you allowed yourself to do that. You should have got the bigger, clunky ones and sacrificed a little sexual attractiveness. Like, this is all the stuff that human beings negotiate. Oh. Yeah.
Well, you know, dogs don't have sex unless reproduction is possible. You know what I mean? Like, they don't just do it unless they're, like, the female dog, unless she's in heat, she doesn't have sex.
Right. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Oh, well,
but
it's a different animal.
We seem, yeah.
The human beings actually cloak their sexuality. The female cloaks the female is designed by nature. Unlike a dog, a female human is trying to keep a mate around so that they'll continue to provision offspring.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is all, let me tell you, chicks are using sex to lure males to doing stuff for them. Like, what a shock this is.
You're kidding. Does that really happen? But
what's going on. At the fundamental root of it, that is in the game. Yes.
That's so funny. But even when we don't have kids, we still do it, right? I mean, we still want to keep the mate around. Yeah, I mean, even if we don't have offspring to provision, we want ourselves provision, I guess.
Yes, that, absolutely. That's exactly what's happening.
Your show kind of depresses me.
No, it's grand. This is a grand vision of human nature, and in fact, it's really the most spectacular insight, I believe, in the history of our species, that there have been many brilliant insights. There have been Einsteins and there have been Newtons. But to actually understand what we are, what we're here for, in other words, what our purpose is and how it is that we operate and on what, you know, essentially we're able now to look inside the programming of what it means to be a human. And to understand it, I think the implications for improvement on human life, not an improvement on humans, but improvement in human relationships and how it is that they negotiate conflicts, et cetera, I think there is spectacular promise for greater understanding.
Yeah. I don't see how you'd ever be able to get married because you always would know what people are doing.
All right. That's a topic for another night, AJ.
Okay. Well, thanks so much. I love your show, guys. Right. Take care. Bye.
Thank you. You bet.
Thanks, AJ. Thank you for the call. Really appreciate it.
All right. Enough for one night?
Enough for one night. All right. We're going to get to the millennials and the parenting style next time.
Good.
All right. Dr. Lau, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.